Going through the numbers again from this D-Day remembrance, it's D-Day plus 75 years. And what an incredible undertaking, the most ambitious, massive amphibious invasion in world history, maybe something unlike anything we will likely ever see again, led by Dwight David Eisenhower, who went on to be president of the United States, of course, the supreme Allied commander. And when you look back at the numbers and the number of casualties, on D-Day itself, 2,499 Americans died, 3,100 were wounded. Almost 2,000 were missing, never accounted for. Lost in the water, lost somewhere. And the sacrifice of those young people, 17, 18, 19 years old, many of them, running onto the beaches, parachuting behind enemy lines, giving the last full measure of devotion. And the president of France and all the others gathered today at the American Cemetery in Normandy. An incredibly moving event, in my estimation. James Carafano here is the director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies and vice president of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. James, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be with you. So, all right, slight edit. You know, most of the average age of the GI was not like 17, 18 years old. They're actually mostly a little older in their mid-20s. And so, we have this vision of kind of blue-eyed country boys, you know, on the front lines. But, the Army in World War II really was this massive cross-section of America where you could find a 32-year-old taxi driver from the Bronx, you know, right next to a 16-year-old kid from, you know, a Mississippi farm that lied about his age to get, you know, into the Army.
So sure.
It was a very egalitarian generation that fought World War II.
There's no question about that. And, you know, you could have a school teacher right next to a high school dropout, right next to a farm kid, as you point out, and a cross-section of America. But what an incredible undertaking. And I wonder what kind of effect this has on the generations today. I mean, look at the people today that are 26 years old, still living in mom's basement. You talk about being in the mid-20s here. It's a different mindset, isn't it?
Well, I will say that, well, first of all, you know, every generation is the greatest generation, and we shouldn't be too mythical about the World War II generation. I mean, it was a generation that was deeply conflicted. Remember, these were kids that came out of the Depression. I mean, they were the first generation in a long time that actually said, "Jesus, maybe there won't be an American dream. You know, maybe this is the new norm." They had watched their fathers and grandfathers fight in World War I and come home and tell horrible, horrible stories. So there's actually letters and diaries, because, you know, I'm a historian in real life.
Sure.
You know, kids writing in the late 30s and 40s said, "Gee, you know, we don't know if we can do this. You know, we don't know if we're as tough as the doughboys were." And so they were really a generation that proved their mettle in battle. And I always say it's every generation is the greatest generation. There's lots of kids living in mom's basement, but this military today is an all-volunteer military. It's made up of most of young men and women in their 20s, and these kids do things that are every bit as courageous and inspiring and as daring and as tough as guys did in the jungles of Papua New Guinea and, you know, storming ashore in Omaha Beach.
I think you make a great point there. Yes, the young people today in the all-voluntary military of the United States do incredible things today, but the undertaking that was D-Day, the tens of thousands of ships, the gross tonnage, 450,000 pounds of ammunition, for example, shipped from the United States, is just one example of the incredible undertaking. And to make it possible to pull it, maybe the greatest misdirection play in world history. We had the Germans looking the wrong way, didn't we?
Yeah. So that was, we did this thing called Fortitude North and Fortitude South, where, look, I mean, the Germans could read a map. They knew there's only so many places that the Americans could land, and the British and the Canadians. And we knew that we weren't going to fool them 100%. But we also knew that most of the German tank reserves were not at the front lines, because since the Germans didn't know exactly where we might land, they wanted to be able to make sure that they got the tanks to the place that they actually landed. And so in addition to, you know, bombing railways and other things to kind of slow the ability of, to move to the front, we put together these basically fictitious armies to confuse the Germans as to where we might go ashore. And we were just hoping for 24, 48, 72 hours, you know, enough time to get the Americans, to get our own tanks on shore, so we could have a foothold that the Germans couldn't kick us out. It actually worked quite well. It was one of the most successful deception operations in military history.
I don't think most people realize, James, how close it really was. James Carafano here from the Heritage Foundation. I don't think a lot of people today realize how close World War II really was in the end, because there was a race towards atomic weapons. The Germans were certainly in that race. We beat them to the punch, of course, and we closed out business there in April of 1945. But it was a close finish, wasn't it?
Well, you know, D-Day was a near thing. I mean, there was a point. So, you know, there were five beaches. Omaha was the really pivotal beach because it connected everything together and really made it, you know, a footprint as opposed to little isolated pockets of people ashore like on Dunkirk.
Right.
And Omaha, because the Germans had just, by accident, rotated a division to the beach to practice, you know, being alerted and moving to the beach in case the Allies landed. And they just happened to be there the day the guys came and shot Omaha Beach. So that was a really, really tough fight. And in the first 24 hours, Omar Bradley, his overall commander, actually, you know, at one point considered that it was a failure and was going to pull the troops off the beach. And the plan completely fell apart. But what happened is, just like in the movie Saving Private Ryan, small groups of men worked their way up the bluffs and cleared the trench line. And that's what really allowed them to what's called beach exits, where you could, the space between the bluffs, you could drive down the beach, open those off so the American troops could move off the beach. And, you know, we all know the Russians actually bore a lot of the fighting against the German army. It took, you know, we lost 500,000. They lost millions.
Correct.
What really sealed Germany's fate was the ability to have a real two-front war, right? I mean, they just could not, you know, fight the Americans and British storming across France and fight the Russians. And that's what really sealed the fate. And I always remind people, is go back and read the plans. Read Hitler's plan for what the world would look like after World War II. Read Tojo's plan. Read Mussolini's plan. And there was no space in there for freedom or liberty. This would have been a planet in which the word of liberty would have been excised from the dictionary. And people forget that as you know, flawed a planet as it is, and as imperfect some of our allies were, that those words would have vanished from history if the United States had not partnered and fought World War II.
James Carafano, I'm going to leave it right there. Brilliant summary, brilliant analysis. Greatly appreciate you being here. A pivotal day, D-Day plus 75 years. Thank you so much. Great commentary from James Carafano from the Heritage Foundation. Quick break. We'll be right back.
Wyckoff Wellness welcomes back Dr. Chi for individual fingernail and tongue analysis June 10th through 15th. Fingernail and tongue changes may indicate problems with digestion, heart disease, blood sugar problems, and more. Call Wyckoff Wellness at 517-333-7270 to schedule your individual evaluation with Dr. Chi for only $40. Appointments are limited. Wyckoff Wellness in East Lansing is also hosting a free seminar with Dr. Chi Tuesday, June 11th at 6 p.m. Call 517-333-7270 to schedule today or go to wyckoffwellness.com.
The Michigan Chamber of Commerce, celebrating 60 years of being the leading voice for business.
I'm Wendy Block, Vice President of Business Advocacy for the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. The Michigan Chamber has been the state's leading business advocacy organization for the past 60 years. Every day we work with state lawmakers in Lansing to promote and support policies that are essential for job creation, economic growth, and free enterprise. Our advocacy team defends business interests and actively promotes pro-business legislative initiatives. Whether it's education, environment, healthcare, or infrastructure, we are committed to standing up for all businesses, large and small. The Michigan Chamber delivers powerful advocacy and business solutions on behalf of our 6,000 members, representing 1 million employees across the state. We are proud to be the leading voice for business in Michigan.
Join the Michigan Chamber of Commerce today at michamber.com. The Michigan Chamber of Commerce, the leading voice for business, moving Michigan forward.
Opioid addiction can affect anyone, any neighborhood, any day.
It happened to me.
I'm recovering.
I lost my son.
One in four patients on long-term painkiller therapy struggles with addiction. But together, we can stop the cycle and end this deadly epidemic. Learn more at michigan.gov/stopoverdoses. Sponsored by the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.